The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and your understanding. Good evening, my name is Norma and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Robert C.
Good evening, my name is Robert and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank my friend John for asking me to participate tonight. I love this meeting. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel very much the way that I felt when I was about 7 or 8 years sober and I was asked to do the main talk here. And I remember talking to Clancy about that. He said, oh, don't worry about it. He said, just don't get up there and try to be cute. And he said, just talk to the newcomer. So I remember him telling me that, and that's exactly what I'm going to try and do tonight. If you're new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I certainly hope that you'll find here what I found. I found myself a brand new life. I had no idea how to get this life. I had no idea I wanted this life. What I do know is that my parents tried to tell me about this life. But I always thought my parents were wrong, you know, very strict. Hit me like a ton of bricks one day. I had done something wrong, and my father wasn't very happy about it. And I remember my dad looking at me and said, boy, don't you know I was a boy one time? And I said, well, I guess he was, you know, because as long as I had known my father, he was a grown man. I had never thought of him as being a boy one time, you know. But my father, I'm a very, very fortunate guy. I had very good parents. I had 3 brothers, 2 sisters, and I was taught right from wrong. You know, I was born and raised in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, which I did not like. I just wanted to get out of Pine Bluff, Arkansas. You know, I did pretty well. I didn't do well in school academically. I did well athletically, you know. I love sports, you know, and I did pretty well there. As a result of that, I was able to go to college on a baseball scholarship, you know. As far as drinking, there was no drinking in my home. I never saw my mother or my father take a drink of alcohol, you know. And I didn't start drinking until I came to Los Angeles, actually, you know. And I got to tell you, drinking alcohol for me was really very good. I had a lot of fun when I was drinking until it turned. And then I was having no fun. In fact, I didn't know that I was an alcoholic until this. I used to work on the police department. I didn't know I was an alcoholic until the captain called me into his office one morning. And he told me that he felt that I was an alcoholic. He gave me the 20 questions you see around here. You had me to take those 20 questions. And I answered those questions. That's one of the first tests, or one of the only tests I've ever passed in my life. You know? And after I answered those, he says to me, he says, the way you answered these questions, you're an alcoholic. And my first thought, well, who wrote that? You know, I didn't say that to him, though. You know, so that is what got me introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. They sent me to a meeting downtown for all law enforcement officers, and that's where I first learned about alcoholism and this group, because I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous even existed. I really didn't. After that, I think I went to that meeting maybe 2 Mondays in a row, and I thought I was doing fine. You know, I started drinking again. You know, I had no idea I could not stop drinking. And what happened, I started showing up for work late, not going to work. They were not happy about that, so they figured I was doing a lot of drinking. I showed up for work one morning, and they put me on the breathalyzer right there in the police station in full uniform. You know, and I'll never forget what I blew. I used to think it was a big number, but nowadays that's a small number. I blew a .23. You know, when I blew that, they looked at that, and then they would look at me, and then they start calling the other guys over. Hey, come here, look at this, you know. And I was pretty proud. I said, yeah, hey, that's me. I can go out there and give you the field sobriety test, no problem, you know. But they were not amused. You know, as a result of that, I got suspended from the for about 10 days without pay. And I just continued to drink. They gave me every opportunity. They took me to a rehab center to try to help me because they say, Robert, you're a good officer and we want you to stay here. You know, and they did everything they could to help me. But I just didn't think anything was wrong. I began to think these guys are picking on me. I'm a victim, you know. They've had guys out in bars shooting their guns off, drunk, and they didn't have to go to AA, you know. And finally what happened, they got tired of my shenanigans, and they sent me downtown to LAPD headquarters. That's a bad deal. You don't want to go down there, you know. And I'll never forget, I sat in front of three commanding officers, and what they did, it was a trial board is what it was. They recommended termination for me. And I was just devastated, you know, about that. And I had no idea what I was going to do. My life just totally went downhill. In fact, before I got here to you, I was totally homeless. You know, I couldn't stand to look at myself, let alone look at somebody else. But I have always believed in a God. And I do believe it was God that directed me here. You see, I got sent to the VA hospital. And that is where I began to hear the message. The VA hospital introduced me to the Pacific Group. The Pacific Group has been nothing but kind to me. The people here have been really nice. You see, I didn't feel anything like you look. You know, I thought if you knew me, you wouldn't want me in here. I didn't even feel like I deserved to sit next to you. I didn't feel good about myself, but you were always very kind. You'd give me a smile and tell me that I was welcome here. As a result of that, working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what you said was get a sponsor. Sponsors for me is one of the most important things you can do. Frank Jones sponsored me for 30 years. I love that man. I love Frank. My sponsor now is Paul C. I love Paul. You know, there are a lot of good people in this group. A lot of good people in this group. You know, I have a son that has this disease. Demetrius hung around Alcoholics Anonymous for about 15 or 20 years. It was hard for him to get sober. But my son today is finally sober. What you have done for me, you turned me back into a good son to my father and my mother. My father just passed in August. He was 100 years old. But he got a chance to see his son. He got his son back. My mother, before she passed, she saw me sober. That's a big deal to me. I have four children. I have 13 grandchildren. I love them to death. Because of you, I'm able to spend a lot of quality time with those children. You know, they come over to my house once a month on Sundays and I cook dinner. And we have such a wonderful time. The little girls with my oldest daughter, they call me Papa. When they want something, they call me Poppy. And they get it, too. I have a little grandson. I don't know how many of you parents, young parents, know about Beyblades, but I know all about Beyblades. Because me and my 10-year-old son play Beyblades. I told him what it really was. It's really, I don't know if you're about my age. We used to use these spinning tops. I said, it's nothing but spinning tops. He said, no, it isn't, Papa. He gets all upset when I tell him what it is, you know. But that's what it is. That's exactly what it is. I've been reflecting over my life lately, and it is absolutely amazing to me, even today, that I was able to get sober. Because I didn't believe you felt like me. I didn't believe you drank like me. I didn't think you understood me. I just had no clue about that. But I have good friends here. I have good friends. I have to say that because I'm so proud to have friends. Because at one while, I had no friends. Perhaps I had friends, but I didn't know how to be a friend. But I have friends today, and I really love that. My life is really, really good. And it's not anything that I did myself, because I couldn't do this. I did it from trying to work the steps to the very, very best of my ability. And I have a sponsor that I talk to. I have friends that I talk to. And I try to do what is asked of me, no matter what it is. I love AA. I'm going to wrap this up, and I like to wrap it up with this little story, in case you didn't really know how bad my drinking was. I didn't know alcohol was causing a problem. But these two little boys who lived next door to me, one was 7 years old, and one was 5 years old. And a little 7-year-old said to his 5-year-old brother, he says, "You know, I think we're old enough to start cussing." And the 5-year-old goes, "Okay." So the 7-year-old says to his 5-year-old brother, "You use the word, I'm going to use the word hell, and you use the word fat ass." His little brother goes, "Okay." So the next morning they went down for breakfast, and the mother looked at the 7-year-old and said, "So, honey, what would you like for breakfast this morning?" 7-year-old said that he thinks he scratched his head. He said, "Oh, hell. Just give me a bowl of Cheerios." She goes, "What?" She doesn't like this answer. She grabs one from the table, slams him into the door, slams the door, and comes back and she looks at the 5-year-old. She says, "So, honey, what would you like for breakfast?" He says, "I don't know either, but you can bet your fat ass I don't want no Cheerios." So, I didn't know what was causing it. But if you're new, please keep coming back. This program works. Thank you so much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Hilda F.
My name's Hilda. I'm an alcoholic. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, John, for asking. And I love listening to Cookie. Oh, hell. Let's see. I was just thinking, I don't know that Robert and I could be more different, actually. I'm not even sure where Arkansas is. But that's part of what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Because I get it. I get his talk. And, you know, I grew up in London, and I'm an only child and an only grandchild, so I know absolutely nothing about children or grandchildren or any of that. But I know about having early access to alcohol and loving it. I loved everything about alcohol long before I ever drank it. And, you know, when I drink, I'm really just a lying bedwetting whore. And I didn't want to be that, and I wasn't shooting for that. But the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes me, it's around page 33, and I'm paraphrasing badly, but it basically says, it doesn't matter how much you drink or how often you drink, it's what happens when you drink, and that many who are merely potential alcoholics often become the real thing in a relatively short amount of time, particularly true of women. And I'm just one of those women, you know. By 16, I had an ulcer. At 17, I got done for drunk driving. At 18, I had a heart attack. And 6 months later, I was in my first mental hospital. And that's when drink was working. And, you know, I'm just a train wreck when I drink. And, you know, I used to love... Casey Crane had a great definition of crossing the invisible line. It always stuck with me because he said, you know, he crossed the invisible line when he stopped bragging about his drinking and he started lying about how much he drank. And that was the best definition I ever got. And it made so much sense to me because I was just never out of trouble. In and out of mental hospitals, and the last mental hospital I was in, I was in for 14 and a half months. I had been committed for being a danger to myself and others. And even there, I went AWOL to drink. You know, it was always about the drink for me. And I was back and forth and back and forth, back to England, back to the States. And every time I got in trouble, done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, you know, I'd move, you know, because it was obviously time. And I'd go to somewhere like England. I'd go home and I get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I just think, you know, America was better, you know. And that's really my drinking in a nutshell. It was always going to be better somewhere else, and everywhere I went, there I was. And I ended up in some really dodgy countries and some really dodgy situations. And, you know, I'm an example of surviving really horrible things when you drink like a young woman like I did in places like I did. And I am definitely a survivor. The last time I got out of a really bad situation, I remember thinking, you know, if I wasn't drinking, these things wouldn't happen. And then my next thought was, well, it could have been worse. And I was drinking again. You know, I'm a goalpost drinker. I'm one of those drinkers that says, if it gets bad, I move the goalpost back just a little bit. I think, well, it gets worse. I move the goalpost back just a little bit. You know, the worst happens, and I think, oh, hell, they could have killed me, and I just move that goalpost back one more time. And I just didn't know it was alcoholism. And I had an uncle who tried to 12-step me when I was 18, and he was on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no clue why he was telling me about it. You know, glad it was working for him. But a few years later, when it all went horribly wrong, I thought about him, and he was still in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I thought I'd give it a go. And the first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was New Year's Eve 1989. I picked New Year's Eve because I really thought no real alcoholic would quit drinking on New Year's Eve. I know today only alcoholics pick a date, right? Like virgins don't go for pregnancy tests. It just doesn't happen. So I went to this meeting in Papillion, Nebraska, and they were talking about A's the father and we're the children, and I just knew that wasn't the right answer because I'm a seeker. You know, I went to Israel, please, right? I just, I knew that wasn't it, and I spent over 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life took off, and it was fantastic, and jobs were better, and money was better, and everything was better, except that I was sitting in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous dying of alcoholism, because I didn't know. I didn't know. And I drank after 3.5 years, and I drank for 9 months. And I've heard people stand at podiums and say, if you want to pick up where you left off, pick up a drink tomorrow, and that's not my experience. When I started drinking after not drinking, my drinking was 10 times... worse and more. My blackouts were longer. The people I woke up next to were uglier. You know, the beds were wetter. It just wasn't pretty. And I got the morning after was my last night before. It's the 20th of July, 1993. I woke up in my own bed, which had become a bonus. I was alone, which was a bigger bonus. But the bed was wet, and I was dressed from work, and that's my new normal. And I didn't think really a lot about it until I went into the bathroom, and my hose were all ripped, and there was blood everywhere, and I had no clue what had happened the night before, and I had a moment. You know, I heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous share about the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I think, God, you're so dramatic. But that morning, I knew who they were, you know, and I did not care when I was unpredictable to you. But that morning, I realized I was unpredictable to me. And I called English Speaking AA. And I was thinking about the meetings like in California and Florida and, you know, big meetings where you could come in late, leave 5 minutes early and call it a home group. And I was in Holmesbrook, Holland. And when I walked into the room, there were 7 people in the room. For an hour and a half. I know today that I got sober exactly where I needed to. You know, I learned principles before personalities. You have to when you hate everybody in your home group. Because I needed them, you know. But I'm grateful, my first sponsor, she did not tell me everything was going to be okay because I wasn't drinking. What she told me was, nobody wraps you in cotton wool just because you stopped drinking. She told me the program of Alcoholics Anonymous would help me learn how to live, whether I had cotton wool on me or not. And I'm grateful for that today. You know, she told me that Alcoholics Anonymous is not high school. This is not about making friends or being popular or getting a job or losing a job or getting a wife or getting a husband or getting married or getting divorced or stopping swearing or stopping smoking. Or it's not about any of that. Some of that happens and it's fluff. Alcoholics Anonymous is about staying sober and helping somebody else do the same. And if I keep it that simple, I get to stay. And I am grateful for that because I was, as our book describes, unlovable in my cusps when I got it to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, nobody wanted to be my friend. You know, nobody wanted to take me to coffee because I was obnoxious and really horrible. And slowly, slowly, Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me grow up. It's helped me become a useful member of society. You know, Sharon shares that if you're here with us tonight, there are 10 people sleeping better, 10 people digesting their dinner better because you're here with us. And I have to tell you, my mom is one of the 10. You know, I called my mom collect from foreign jails when she could do nothing, nothing but worry about me, you know. And today I have a great relationship with my mom because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, she just turned 75, and we had a surprise party for her. She's so sweet. She all week she kept saying, "I can't believe I'm turning 75." I was like, "Yeah, I know." You know, and she was like, "I don't know what I'm gonna do." I was like, "Yeah, it's a hard one." You know. And even when Julie texted her, she answered in one word: "Sure." You know. And then we got to surprise her with a big surprise party and really treat her like she should be treated, you know. I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous gave my mother back the daughter she deserved instead of the one she had, you know, because that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to you a lying bedwetting whore, and somewhere along the way you've turned me into a good friend, a loving and monogamous wife, and a true daughter to my mother. For that I thank you.
And tonight our main speaker is Rosie T.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Rosie, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank John for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope with you all. I want to thank Marianne and Linda. Linda wanted me to tell you that she's helped me very much. And I definitely would like to wish my sponsor, 44, a happy birthday for 44 years today. Sharon Brooks, thank you very much for being my sponsor. My sobriety date is July 5th of 1992. My home group is Bellflower Big Book Group, and my sponsor is Sharon, and I'm current with her. I'm a total byproduct of good sponsorship. I've been blessed beyond belief. Somebody like me, when I came to you guys, I was not even an alcoholic. I didn't know that I was dying from alcoholism. And you guys took me in, and you guys have taught me everything that's decent in my life. For that, I thank you. I'm going to talk about drinking and alcohol because I never want to leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous having you wonder if I drank or not. So I started drinking at the age of 16, and I'm the kind of drunk that I love not only the effect of alcohol, but I like the taste, I like the glasses, I like the fellowship, I like to party with people. I'm not a stay-home drunk. I love everything that goes with the drinking. I discovered that I can have a little bottle in the trunk of my car, and I can start the party in the parking lot. Many times I never made it into the nightclub. I'm a nightclubber. I love to dance. For a long time, I used to think that I was the salsa queen of Los Angeles. I've looked at some videotapes, and I was no salsa queen. But I'm the youngest of seven. My daddy died of alcoholism at the age of 49. All of my sisters drink. My brother, you know, visibly, I know he's an alcoholic. I've known it all of my life. I was allowed to drink at home. I never got in trouble. I was allowed to smoke cigarettes. My first experiments was done with my siblings. So I didn't have any problems at all drinking. I started to drink not because my life stopped working, but because my best friend Alex had a bottle of vodka. I took a swig, and my life was never the same. I had an overdose at the age of 19. Nobody called 911. Nobody took me to the ER. And I remember going to my God, and I remember quitting using drugs, promising to God that I would not use drugs forever. I continued to drink from the ages of 19 to 25. I drank, and when you don't have anything in your system to enhance your drinking, you're going to go into blackouts. And I had many of those. I came to in places that I should have never been, with people I never should have been with. And at the age of 25, you guys, I believe through inventory, because everything that I share from, you know, from the podium, I got to tell you that I found out here through inventories and being with you. I am not one of those alcoholics that came to the meetings knowing that I was an alcoholic and knowing my story. I was in full flight from reality. I was a mental outright defective, and I didn't know that I was dying. And I can tell you that between the ages of 25 to 29, I have lived what I call my bottom. And I started to drink every day. I started to drink in the morning. I started to drink just to drive to work. That's another thing. I'm one of those drunks that I've always shown up to work. I don't know why I had that ethics of showing up to work, but I've always showed up to work. Drunk, hungover, clusters of pizza on my sweater because Grandma Nia and pizza didn't mix well. But I showed up, and so because of that, I believe that I had a hard time believing that I was an alcoholic or even thinking that I had a problem with alcohol, because I had a car and I had a couple bucks in my pocket, and because I continued to work. And so I quickly checked up with the drug dealer guy at the age of 25, I know, and my life was hell. The guy was married. He wasn't supposed to be married, but you know how that story goes. And the guy was in the uglier side, you know, couldn't even dance. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization on my part, totally. And what happened to me, you guys, is that I went down, and I went down hard, and I went down quick. I look back at those 3-4 years of my life, and it's pretty sad. I lived to drink, and I couldn't have imagined my life without drinking. But I didn't know that, you see. It became my normal life. At the age of 29, November of 1991, my brother had just gotten back from Nicaragua, and he brought back some homemade rum. We have really good rum back home. And I had just gotten back from the Galapagos Island in Ecuador, and I brought back some sugar cane, syrupy alcohol. And I don't know if you guys have ever had that, but it's the best thing that there is. I mean, once it stays down, it's on. This was a Sunday, and I know my days because my car always drove me to different nightclubs, different nights, all by itself. Wednesday nights, we would go to the Quiet Canyon. On Thursday, we would go to the Grand. On Fridays, we would go to the Mayan. And this was a Sunday because I ended up at Steven's Steakhouse. And my brother got up. We were drinking from noon to about 9:30 p.m. And my brother got up to leave. And I don't think anything about, you know, he's been drinking all day. He takes off. My mother always said he drove better when drinking. Kid you not. And sometimes we would go camping on his beautiful van, and he would be so drunk that he would be falling asleep at the wheel. And my mom would say, "Hey, Mario's falling asleep. Give him a beer," you know, and I swear. So he took off, and I don't think anything of it. And that night, he totaled his van. He hit the center divider on the 101 and the 5, hit the wall on the right, and hit the center divider again, lost the wheel. And he ended up at the right-hand side of the freeway without hitting anybody. And he went to jail. My sister went to bail him out. The following morning, I don't know anything about this. I'm dancing at Steven's Steakhouse. The following morning, he calls me up. He says, "You know, would you come help me pick up the van?" I said, "Sure." You know, we took off. My brother walked away from that car wreck with a swollen chin from that wheel hitting him and the burn from the seatbelt. You know, when we got to the place where we were going to pick up the van, I looked at the van and I looked at my brother, and I couldn't believe he had walked away from that car wreck. We came home with $50 in the back seat of that van. That van was completely totaled, and he gets sentenced to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And My brother doesn't stay sober that Christmas or that New Year's Eve, and around January, he started going to meetings. He calls me up. By this time, I have lost every decent job that I've ever had in my life. I'm working in downtown L.A. on 8th and Hill. We call it the Dungeon. It's still there. It's a ballroom place where men come to pay to dance with women that work there at night. My job was from 10 to 7 p.m. Answering phones. That's all I did, hiring the women that work there at night. And, you know, we talk a lot about seconds and inches here. If I had any other job, my brother could have not called me every morning as he did after his morning attitude adjustment meeting to tell me about you. If I would have been anywhere else, I wouldn't have been able to do that. My brother went to his first meeting and he came back. He calls me up. He says, those people are crazy. You know, they're telling stories and, you know, I'm looking for somebody to sign my court card and I'll pay you if you go get my court card signed. I had no idea what he was talking about, you know, and I'm at the other end and I'm drinking. I'm drinking at work he tells me this story because he remembers this conversation. I don't remember talking to my brother about anything, but he says that I told him that I had heard Alcoholics Anonymous worked and that he, being the alcoholic in our family, should go back to AA. I don't know why I would say that to my brother. I'd never been to AA. I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. Except for Sarah T and My Name is Alice, those books that I read in junior high. I know I'm dating myself. And so what happened is that after his second and third meeting, you had him. My brother became your biggest cheerleader and he couldn't wait to tell me about it. He came home and gave all the siblings big books. We're all girls. He's the only guy. And we just started mocking him because, you know, he came in every single time and he would talk about God. God, 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 AA, God, AA, God. We're Catholics, man. We know God. You know, we go to church once a year on Palm Sunday. And I don't get that my brother is all lit up about this God thing, you know. And he's praying all the time. And we just started calling him Brother Mario. But he had my ear. Every morning he would go to his morning attitude adjustment meeting and he would call me to tell me about you. I come to understand that he was carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous without realizing he was 12-stepping me. You know, because I kept hearing about how he drank and how he felt and what happened to him and why my dad died of alcoholism. And it ended up that we have siblings from other women that my dad used to sleep with. And my brother was vomiting everything, you know. You know how we are when we're new? You know, you ask a newcomer how they're doing and they take off, you know. You know, they come up for air once in a while and then, you know, and that was my brother, you know, and I had time. That's all I had in this job. So I heard everything that he had to say. And I wanted to tell my brother. I wanted to tell my brother that I was drinking every day. I wanted to tell my brother that I was living with this man that I didn't even like. I wanted to tell my brother that I was dealing drugs. I wanted to tell my brother the kind of life I was living. And the words didn't come out. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm not used to sharing anything of importance with anybody. You know, I was brought up in a family where we don't air out our dirty laundry. And I'm also very self-sufficient. I don't need your help. I'm not going to ask for anything. And so, you know, I just didn't say anything, but I certainly was identifying with everything he was sharing with me, especially how he felt and the blackouts he was having and the coming twos. And I'm just like, I'm drinking, you know. By this time, I'm working in downtown L.A. I'm living in Downey, and I could no longer take the 20-minute ride without taking a drink. I would have to, you know, stop by the freeway, get on, you know, get out. And I was no longer able to drive for 20 minutes without putting something in my body. And if you would have asked me if I had a problem, I would have said no, because I have no idea. I'm in full flight from reality. That life became my normal life. And so what happened to me, you guys, is that my brother took a trip. And before he took a trip, he says, you ought to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because you're going to love Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why my brother would think that. But before he left, he says, you know, you want to go to AA and you want to pick up a directory. And you go to the literature table and that's where you're going to pick up. And it's a list of meetings and you're going to find a meeting that you like because you're going to love AA. And my brother takes a trip. And for whatever reason, I missed hearing the voice. I missed hearing the voice of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know this, but I know that I'm missing. And so I ended up being at the Downey Tuesday night second chance meeting on a Tuesday night, not because I needed to be there, not because I thought that I needed to go. I wanted to pick up a directory, like he said. And I showed up to this meeting, and it was a big meeting, and there was a lot of people smoking in the parking lot. And I remember sitting in my car and waiting for your meeting to be over because I was embarrassed. I didn't know what to expect of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And it was across the street from a bar I used to drink, you know, the Guardsman. And so I just kind of figured that somebody may, you know, look at me walking into a meeting of AA, you know. And mind you that I pee all over your front lawns any day because I'm a peer. I'm a peer too, Hilda. And I'm better because I never did it in bed. And I love you. And so I'm embarrassed to walk into this meeting. And so I waited for your meeting to be over. And I ran into the literature table. And Marguerite was standing next to the literature table after the meeting. You know, I walk in. I'm wearing my black leather miniskirt, my little tube top. You know, and I'm a little in the chunky side because I've been drinking everything beer back, you know, and when you drink a lot of beer 24/7, you're going to be a little chunky, you know what I mean? And I'm wearing my little tube top and, you know, I have no neck because I'm all swollen, you know, I look like a bullfrog, you know, and I have no toenails due to malnutrition, you know, and this is before acrylics, ladies. That's a vision. And, but I'm going to go dancing. I don't know about you guys, but my whole house is on fire and I'm going to vacuum, you know, and that happens to me in sobriety too, you know. I took one look around. There were beautiful ladies in this meeting with the little beehive dos and nice jewelry. And I already told you what I looked like. And I'm thinking I don't fit here either, you know. I took the directory and I gave Marguerite $5 because I knew you poor people needed the money. And she laughed, you know. She's like, no, honey, it's free for you, you know, keep coming back. And I looked around and I'm like, you know, this is not for me. And I waited for the following Tuesday because I thought you guys met once a week. And I ended up at the Hoxie meeting, which is 5 minutes from Downey. It's at Norwalk, you know, on a Tuesday night. And I walked in there and it was a biker meeting. And you guys look a little rough and all tattooed down. And I sat down for a minute. And I'm thinking maybe I could help you guys out. Then I hear the guy that's your treasurer, you know, take your money, say that he had gone to prison by his own admission from the podium. And I'm thinking, wow, man, you people are dumb, you know. You got the guy that went to prison taking your money, you know, and I didn't get it. In my head, I thought, you know, you keeping my brother sober, the least I can do is come and y'all take care of this meeting, you know. You guys visibly need help. And thank God for old-timers in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because they didn't ask me for anything else but to keep coming back. You know, they asked me, they needed help with the coffee commitment, and that reassured me that you needed my help. So I came back, and I helped you with your coffee. Within 3 months, you asked me to secretary the meeting, and I intuitively knew you wanted me to audit the guy that'd been to prison. I came, and I was with you guys a while completely crazy. I did not know that I was dying of alcoholism. And you know what? I've seen a few hands stand up as newcomers today. You know, please stay here long enough to find out if you're an alcoholic. Because if you suffer from alcoholism, we have a solution here for you. There is so many other 12-step programs. Find out where you belong. This is very important. I was sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for 9 months, and I had no idea that I was dying. And the only decent thing, the only good thing that I did is that I didn't drink or use between that meeting. And I stayed here long enough for me to identify with you guys. And this is why it's important that when we go to meetings, we share about alcoholism, you know, hopefully to affect the identification with somebody else. This is what I'm doing here tonight, you know. And so what happened to me is that I sat in that meeting and I did. I did coffee. I secretary the meeting. And I knew my case was different. I liked step 1, 2, and 3. I couldn't do a 4-step because my case is different. I'm not as bad as you guys. The only defect that I thought I had was lust. I thought about sex 24/7. I wasn't doing anything, but I thought it. I'm Catholic. You know, you think it, you did it, you're guilty, you know. And so I felt guilty. And what happened to me is that at 9 months of being dry at that meeting with no sponsor, no fellowship, some lady came and shared with us about embezzling money. And that was my moment for me. I sat down and I remember it like if it was yesterday, because I too embezzled money. And along with that memory came all the memories of what I just shared with you guys. All the drunk drivings, all the sleeping around, all the coming to, all the money that I've stolen. My mother's face is way up in the high list for me, because my mother used to beg me not to drive. She used to grab my keys and grab my face and ask me to please don't drive. And there's some amends, you know, that we can never really right. There's some wrongs that we can never really right. You know, and my mom, I got a lot of family stuff, a lot of family baggage, you know, that no amends can make that right. And I can only hope to live the rest of my life to make those amends. You know, a simple I'm sorry won't fit the bill at all is what my big book says. You know, I have to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it. And that's important to me. So what happened is that at 9 months, I'm sitting in this meeting and I hear chunks of my story. And all this stuff comes to the forefront, and I was afraid because I didn't have a sponsor and I didn't have a way to go or a fellowship or somebody to go share. And what happened to me in Norwalk is that God disguised himself as a cute guy. He invites me to go play volleyball at the Lakewood speaker meeting. I've never been to a speaker meeting before. I'm 9 months dry. My bloat is all down. I'm wearing my little hot short shorts, my little tube top. My neck is out. I'm ready to go play some volleyball. You know what I mean, Linda? You know? And I took it down to Lakewood, you know, which is the Lakewood speaker meeting. And I'm sitting there, you know, because all I wanted was to play volleyball. And I would once in a while throw cookies at you to make you think that I was a part of the group. And what happened to me is on a Thursday night, Betty Garcia came to share with us. And I'm sitting in that meeting minding my own business. And I can tell you that my life has never been the same since. This lady shared from the podium that all she aimed in life was to be of maximum service to God and the fellows about her. And I've never heard anybody live, you know, say that before. You know, I didn't think, wow, you know, what a chump, you know. I didn't think that. I heard that all she aimed in life was to be of maximum service to God and the fellows about her. And she recited the third step prayer. She said the seventh step prayer from the podium. And when she sat down, she recited the poem of the touch of the master's hand. And all I wanted to do was just go touch this lady, you know. And I ran to her after the meeting and I said, Betty, I normally don't give my phone number out, but you can have it. Like I was asking her out or something, you know. If I would have asked her for her number, I wouldn't have called her. It's really weird, Alcoholics Anonymous, how things happen here, you know, because that lady called me the very next day. And what happened is that she invites me to go to her home group, the Torrance Lomita Alano Club, on a Saturday morning. And that following Saturday, I'm sitting next to Betty. And I can tell you, I was waiting for something to happen to me, you know, and it did. This lady gave me a literature commitment, and I tried to explain to her that I lived in Downey. This is Torrance. There's no way that I can drive for 20 minutes. It's too far away. She laughed out loud at me and gave me the keys to the locker of the literature. And thank God that I was naive enough to not leave the lockers at the Alano Club, that I was not naive enough to take off with the keys and don't come back. Who cares? You know, I came back and I was the literature person for 2 years. And because of that, the following week, she looks at me and she says, have you done an inventory? I says, I don't know what that is. She gets all excited, you know, and she's like, oh my God, you know, she gets the book. And every Saturday morning after that meeting, she would sit me down at that bench down the street and read the big book out loud to me. Out loud, like I couldn't read. And she started telling me about me. Like, she started taking me my inventory, you know. Like, I would give her a little bit of information, and she'd, like, take off. Like, she knew everything about me. And I remember thinking, this lady must be crazy, you know. This she's weird, you know. But I wasn't saying anything. I'm just like, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am. And I wrote an inventory. I took a long time because she wanted my resentments, my fear, my sex, and my secrets. And you had me at my secrets. It wasn't all the money that I had stolen that made me feel like a cockroach. It was the nickel and dime things between my ears. You know, it was the time that I was bullied, you know, when I was 14 years old. On Pico in Vermont, I was made to kneel before some cholas, you know. And I remember that was a dark secret for me because I knew better than to kneel before a human being. And They robbed me. They humiliated me one more time. And sometimes I would give chunks of my soul willingly. And this particular time, it was very tough for me. I tried to commit suicide at the age of 10. You know, and these things happened to me way before I ever took a drink. And I have never told a soul, not a priest, not in confession. You know, and I knew there were secrets because I never told anybody about them. And what happened to me is that I gave that fifth step facing that wall of that Alano Club on a Saturday morning. And she started sharing things about herself as well. And we had a lot of things in common, you know, including dancing on tables. And she started telling me what to do with my sixth and my seventh step. And when I got up from my knees after taking the seventh step prayer, I knew why my brother gave all of us big books. You know, I felt like I was going to be the next Mother Teresa of Calcutta. I was going to go save the world, you know. I felt like I was just gliding, you know, and that lasted for about a week. And then she said, I want a list of people that you think you owe amends to. And I gave her that list the following week. And she looked at the list and she said, where is that ex-employer that you embezzled $7,000 from? I said, what do you mean? She says, you told me that you embezzled $7,000. And I know the amount because I filed taxes on it. I know. And then she says, you know, I don't see the name. We need to make amends. And so I didn't understand what she was talking about, you know. And so I ran back to my Downey meetings and I'm telling all the old timers in Downey, you know, it's like, hey, can you believe my sponsor wants me to go do this? And what do you think? You know, and I don't know if you guys do this at the Pacific group, you know, but I kind of wanted to double check my sponsor's direction, you know, just in case. I'm 2 years sober. I'm walking on water. I don't want to go to jail. And thank God that none of the people that I went to said, you don't have to do what your sponsor said. Thank God. You know what they told me? They told me that I needed to start trusting somebody. And that sponsor, it's a good start. And so, you know, I didn't like that answer. So I went to my childhood God and I said, God, if you don't make me do this amends, I'm going to go feed the homeless in downtown L.A., you know, And I took it down. I started doing hot dogs and burgers, got my nieces and nephews in the car. We took it to 5th and Central, and we were handing out hot dogs and burgers for like 3 months. You know, and by this time, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a real job where I get to take a real lunch. And in one of those lunch times, I opened up the other big book that I like reading sometimes. And it opened up to the page where it says, before you come to my altar, make sure your debts are paid. And I was screwed, you know. There was... I got it, you know. My sponsor said, you know, get a down payment and a payment plan. And I started putting some cash together. And I, you know, finally made the call to meet my ex-boss. And I met him at Foxy's in Downey when Foxy's used to be Foxy's. And I met him there on a Friday at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I told him what I had done. And it sounds very easy behind a podium, you know, 24 years later. But I can tell you that I was scared to death. I just knew that I was going to go to jail, and I told him what I'd done, and I'm crying, and I'm shaking, and, you know, he's looking at me like, you know, like I got two heads, you know, and then I take out the cash, and he looks at the cash, and he looks at me, and says, Rosie, I can't take your money. He goes, you out of anybody knows how many times my own kids have broken into my own home, and they never sat me down to tell me the truth. You out of anybody knows how many times my wife has been missing in action. If you wouldn't mind, I would take a big book for my wife and you and I can work something out, you know, in form of payment. And I know that this doesn't mean anything to you guys, but it means the world to me. I was able to go back to the same company, same office, same computers to close out books for this man for the following 2 years trying to repay a debt. You know, but actions like this is what put myself back together. All I ever wanted to be when I first came into this country was to be white. I wanted to be white and be blonde. That was my dream. That's all I ever aimed, you know, just to be white. And here you are telling me to take some actions to put my soul back together. You know, and I flew to Florida to make amends to a niece that I had been very mean to when she was little. And my sponsor has taught me to ask, you know, after each amends, have I left anything out? Is there anything you want to, you know, share with me? And this young lady, you know, went to town with me, you know. She was telling me things that I've done to her that were not on my inventory because I didn't remember it when I wrote that inventory. But when she said it out loud, I owned it. I knew that I had done those things, you know. And she looked at me and she says, I don't care that you're sober, you know, get out. You know, and I come home and my sponsor, I told my sponsor, I said, that amends didn't work. And she laughs. She says, no, honey, you've done your part. We are here to clean the wreckage of your past. You know, now we move on into making living amends. And thank God for sponsorship. You know, thank God I wouldn't be half the woman that I am today without the kind of sponsorship that I've had. I've been so blessed. You know, my sponsor, Lucretia, by this time is Lucretia, and she's all about the family, you know, and putting the family back together. And, you know, she started telling me to write my niece letters and birthday cards and Merry Christmas cards and to send her little girls gifts, you know, for their birthdays. And I started doing that. And every year that I take a cake in AA, I've always done a little letter that I send out, you know, to my family and friends, close friends, to let them know where I've been the year before. And sometimes I would get the letters back from Jackie, you know, and by her choice, I wouldn't have her address. So I would send them to my sister, you know, I'm following direction. And once in a while, she'd send me a hate email, and I don't know what to do with a hate email. I'd forward it to my sponsor. I figure it was her idea anyway. Let her deal with it. Left to my own devices, I send her a virus. That's how I deal with things. You don't like me, you're going to pay for it, you know? I love that delete thing on my phone, you know? You give me a dirty look, I delete you, you know? That's the level of maturity in my life. And so what happened to Jackie is that over 15 years ago, I'm sitting in my office and I hear her voice. She gives me a call and she says, this is Jackie. And my heart, you know, drops because I'm thinking, here comes the hate one more time. And she's calling me to let me know that she's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and she's calling me to make amends to me. And I would have missed it all. You know, Jackie doesn't get to stay sober. You know, she lost her kids. But now she's sober 5 years. And this last August, I had an opportunity to go to Florida to go to a convention there. And she heard about it. She seen my name on the flyer and she gave me a call and she says, I'm going to make the drive. She knows she lives in Georgia. And she says, I want to make the drive because I want to sit next to you in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and Jackie and I got to spend the day together, you know, and we caught up. And now, you know, we have this friendly, you know, connection. And I want to be clear that a lot of my family members, I don't want to be a part of their life. I want to make that clear. I just, you know, the amends and the living amends is one thing, but it's not necessarily that I want to become their best friends, you know, but I take direction because my life is affected by the direction that I take. I always say that a good sponsor is as good as the direction that the sponsee takes. But I've been well trained in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you guys all know my hubby, you know, Larry came to share at the Downey Thursday night meeting about 23 years ago. And he shared on a Thursday night and he followed me like a lost puppy. He called me the very next day and he's been calling me every day since. We're going to have 21 years of marriage this coming May. And that to me, it's a big deal, you guys, because I don't know anything about loyalty and being faithful. I've always been the kind of gal that's always had the shoebox with the black little phone book, you know. I've always kept the numbers, you know. And I can tell you that in Alcoholics Anonymous, men and women have helped me. As a matter of fact, the most important people in our lives are in this room tonight. You know, and for that, I'm really grateful. You know, I call my sponsor on a daily basis, and I don't have drama on a daily basis. But I tell Sharon everything, you know. I tell Sharon about people I don't like, people that piss me off, the sponsees that I just want to, you know, lit up on fire. And I keep coming back. You know, Hilda touched on her mom. And I got to tell you that when I made amends to my mom, it was an incomplete. I had to go redo more work because more is revealed here. And when I sat down my mom for the second time and I asked her if she wanted to share with me, you know, my mom saw me do things that I didn't know she saw me do. And Alcoholics Anonymous allowed her a platform to express herself about what she has seen her little. I'm the youngest of seven. I was her last baby, you know, and my mom shared all her heartache. You know, she let all this thing out. And my mom lived her last 15 years of life, you know, like the queen that she is. You know, I was able to make that happen for my mom, to make the living amends, to treat her like a mom and not like a best friend. You know, I quit fighting my mom. You know, if she wanted me to wear a sweater on 100-degree weather, man, I was wearing a sweater. on a 100 degree weather. You know, I just quit fighting my mom, and Alcoholics Anonymous did that for me. My mom would come to the Downey Thursday night meeting to give me my cakes, you know, and she would bring tamales to the meeting, you know, because she loved what you guys have done, you know, with me. And thank you. And I can tell you that she was just very proud. I want to share a little bit about grief. You know, 12 years ago, Lucretia dropped dead overnight, you know, and I didn't know that I loved my sponsor the way that I loved her. She had been my sponsor for about 9 years, and she had been my everyday phone call. And she went to the Downey Thursday night meeting, and she had a brain aneurysm when she got home. And then the following day was a Friday, and around noon, the grandkids called me. And that baffles me that the grandkids would have my phone number to call me. And they called me to tell me that, you know, she was brain dead and that they were going to unplug her at 2:30 in the afternoon. And all I did was that I just called Larry, you know, and he met me at the hospital. And I can tell you that I was there and I was present and I was there for the family, but I was completely numb. You know, as we're walking out, I don't know what I'm going to do. I am not the kind of person that always have, you know, a backup plan. You know, I've never had a backup plan, you know, and so I don't know who to call. And you know, somebody pushed the phone number of Clancy, of all people. And I'm thinking, why am I going to call Clancy? You know, I've been brought up in AA that, you know, I call women, right? And I don't know Clancy at this time. I'm not close to Clancy. And as I'm dialing the number, he was out of town, and that man called me back. That man called me back and gave me directions and asked me to call him every day and that he would give me people that I can call, you know, and that's how Sharon came into my life, you know, and I immediately thought I'd made a big mistake. My sponsor, I'm a little kooky. Like, if you know me, and no pun intended there, kooky, I'm a little bit in the quirky side. Like, I like happy, joyous, and free. I like waking up and you know, what is this day going to bring, you know? I don't need coffee. I can just go on. And I remember checking in with my sponsor, and within a couple months, she's like, do you ever have a bad day? I'm like, damn. I had a bad day when my sponsor died, you know, but now she's known me for 12 years, you know, you've been the longest sponsor that I've had, and my life has changed since you've been my sponsor. You have a tendency to level me, and I appreciate that, because left to my own devices, I'm in a little bit full flight from reality. I don't mean to be, but that's just my personality. Some of us are a little grouchy. I'd rather be a little joyful than grouchy. You know what I mean? And what happened with Lucretia, you guys, is that I went into anxiety attacks and panic attacks. You know, Clancy's direction to me was to look at the calendar and don't deviate from anything on that calendar. And I'm going to leave you guys with that. If there is a secret of how, you know, to be here and to be present is to not deviate from what's on the calendar. That has served me well because my sponsor died 12 years ago. My mom died 11 years ago. My sister died 5 years ago. I lost a dog in between that. I lost a job in between that. And to me, it was the darkest times, you know. My mother died of dementia, you know, and that was only a year after Sharon had been my sponsor, and her daddy died of dementia. You know, she was able to walk me. I mean, it's just really weird what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm still baffled by that because I get everything that I need here, you know, and I've never really had it so good. With the grief thing, I know that grief has teeth, and I know that many of you guys here have experienced what grief is. And I can tell you that I haven't had to go anywhere else but to take the seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the same time that Johnny, you know, that I got close to Johnny because I was not close to Johnny. You know, and when my sponsor died, he came and sat me down next to him and told me about when his sponsor died. And he gave me the permission to just sit and be because I don't know how to sit and be. I have to always be doing something. I think that I have to be somewhere else other than where I am. And sometimes I need the reassurance from the old timer that everything is going to be okay. You know, I walked in here today and the love that I felt in this room is uncanny. I had so many of you guys come up to me and tell me, you know, hey, have fun, have a good time. And I feel the love here in this room, you know, and I got to tell you guys, Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that has happened in my life. I hope and I pray that I live the rest of my life knowing what my primary purpose is. I never lose sight of that. because it doesn't matter. I don't have to watch myself when my chips are down and I'm full of grief. It's kind of easy to take my seat and come to meetings when I'm down. I have to watch it when I'm getting the promotions and when I got the extra money, because then you guys become, you know, not the priority in my life. And I have to be very watchful of that. So I'm going to continue to keep coming back. I hope you guys do too. I love you no matter what, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Now we'll stop talking because I'm talking. I'm here to kill a little time while they count the balance, to remind us how lucky we are to be here. You know, alcoholism has been around for 2,000 years at least. They talked about it in the Bible. They couldn't know what to do. They looked not upon the wine when it's red, they said. But when any of us were born, that's not exactly true, but when we were very young, there was no such thing as Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been very fortunate to stumble along into it after we were here for a while. I know I'm one of the few people here that was born before Alcoholics Anonymous started. I was 8 years old when AA was founded, and I had no idea that there'd be anything like it in my life. And finally, some years later, when I walked 7.5 miles from Skid Row in the rain, and my mouth bleeding from my teeth being kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank, and I had no place to turn, all of a sudden AA looked pretty good to me. And much to my surprise, all I had to do was sit there and do what they were doing. I had to do nothing. And every one of us have had that type of experience, I suppose. Somewhere along the line, some more dramatic than others. But it boils down to, remember the time when Bill Wilson was trying to stay sober in his early days. He went down to the hospital where they got him sober. He said, "How could I stay sober?" The doctor said, "Why do you people keep coming down here to ask us questions like that? We can't help you. We get you sober, and 2 weeks later you're drunk again, and you don't understand the problem. Stopping drinking is not the answer." And Bill Wilson took that back and brooded about it for a while. But fortunately, he had an invitation to go to work in Akron, Ohio. So he went out there and stayed sober briefly. And by accident, dropped into the middle of a group of people who were able to help him. We are very fortunate in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are in the main arena of it right tonight. This is the largest and most successful AA meeting in the world, and has been for many years. We've just contributed our annual amount to the central office in New York, based on our attendance, $15,000. And we have a delegate from this group who goes to New York. And our people here are enthusiastic. They fell into a good deal they didn't realize they were getting into. They're forced to get a sponsor. We have forced you to go to meetings. We force you to be mean, because that's how all of us got sober and stayed sober. And I go out to the cemetery every year and thank the man who lays buried there who saved my life, because when he was alive, I hated him. I used to lie awake at night and think, how can I kill that son of a bitch and not get caught? But he made me take actions I didn't want to take, and they saved my life. And so whoever you are, Bob, God bless you. I hope you're having a good evening and a big meeting in the sky. But all over the world tonight, There are meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Many in Los Angeles, many in every city in the world has AA meetings now, including Moscow, including Johannesburg, including Vladivostok, including London, everywhere. I have been in meetings all over the world, and it's a refreshing when you go in and you sit down, you're not quite sure what you're going to be doing, and someone starts reading chapter 5, and you think, ah, I know what this is. I can do this one. So I think this election tonight is one of the few elections in the AA that I know of where actually the members are all get to participate in electing a secretary. Many groups, they can't find someone who will be the secretary. Our group has always had a number of people who would like to be secretary. And I remember founding this group with 12 people in 1963, and hoping someday, I hope we'd get to be 30 so that we could fill up some of the empty seats. And I had no idea that we would one day be the largest and most successful meeting in the world. And it's not because of my own merit, it's because of we have been indeed fortunate of having a succession of secretaries, most recently John, who have done what they should do. They have followed the format, they have defended what we believe in, and we continue to function as a result. Tonight, a number of young ladies still appear to be nominated. Any one of them will be a good secretary. But we just take it for granted. We just forget how lucky we are to be where we are with the enthusiasm of Alcoholics Anonymous. That word enthusiasm is an interesting word. It's from a Greek meaning en within, theos, the expression of God within. That's what enthusiasm is. Enthusiasm can take drab lives and make them colorful.